Today, the Fed uses the F word. Hello again, it's Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Welcome to this post covering finance and prop news with a distinctively Australian flavour. Well, the Dow just hit a new high. And that's quite interesting because it coincided with the Federal Reserve Chairman Jerome Powell calling the risks emanating from frothy stock prices and other potential financial imbalances as manageable. But some current and former central bankers are just not so sure. They worry that the Fed's rock-bottom interest rates, a massive bond buying, might lead to asset price bubbles and excessive risk-taking and leverage that could come back to haunt the economy. And this theme of risk-taking and asset bubbles is frankly everywhere now. We're now at a point where I'm observing excesses and imbalances in financial markets, Dallas Federal Reserve Bank President Robert Kaplan said on the 30th of April. I'm very attentive to that, and that's why I think at the earliest opportunity, I think it will be appropriate for us to start talking about adjusting those purchases. But Powell, for his part, has shown no inclination to pull back on the Fed support for the pandemic-damaged yet recovering US economy. But he's lately sounded a bit more wary about potential dangers to financial stability. After avoiding calling asset prices elevated earlier this year, Powell surprised investors by using the F word to describe the markets when speaking to reporters on April the 28th. "You are seeing things in the capital markets that are a bit frothy," he said, after a two-day meeting at which the Fed opted to maintain its ultra-accommodative monetary posture. "Some of the asset prices are high." But he went on to argue that a growing number of vaccinations and a faster economic reopening were the main forces driving prices higher, not Fed policy. And Powell also pointed out that some of the other factors the Fed looks at to assess financial stability risks are not flashing red. Housing balance sheets are in good shape. Leverage in the financial system is not high, and banks are well capitalized. The overall financial stability picture is mixed, but on balance, it's manageable, he said. Powell is far from alone in sounding wary about exuberance in the financial markets. Asset bubbles are a hot topic these days for the somewhat obvious reason that so many markets are on fire, said J.P. Morgan Head of Cross-Asset Fundamental Strategy, John Normand, in a note recently. The Fed chief faces a quandary when it comes to the market. He wants financial conditions to be easy to help the economy and the jobs market recover from the devastation of the pandemic, but he's also aware that bursting asset bubbles can lead to economic recessions, as occurred in 2001, when high-flying technology company shares crashed, and in 2007, when housing prices crumbled. To help limit the financial fallout from an eventual step back in Fed support, former Bank for International Settlements economic advisor Stephen Chinetti said policymakers should give investors a clearer idea of how they will adjust bond purchases in response to different economic scenarios. Of course, the Fed is currently buying back $120 billion of assets each month and has pledged to keep up that pace until substantial further progress has been made towards its goal of maximum employment and 2% average inflation. Powell has repeatedly declined to be more specific except to say that it is likely to be some time before such progress is achieved. He has, though, promised to give investors ample warning of a coming shift in the Fed's plans. That might not be enough, though, to prevent a fall in the stock market that has frankly become over-dependent on the Fed's largesse. "Speculative markets are tricky," former Fed Governor Jeremy Stein said. "They are hard to manage." That could especially be the case if investors become fixated on the risks of faster inflation. There's been some dry kindling for a while for a steep market decline, but now you can imagine what a spark might be, Harvard University professor Stein added. And former Bank of England policymaker Adam Posen said the Fed and other regulators should act to make the financial system more resilient and thus better able to handle an eventual increase in interest rates. There are things they can do now to reduce the likelihood of that bad things will happen when they're forced to raise rates in early 2023 or sooner than they're currently expecting, said Paulson, who's now president of the Peterson Institute for International Economics in Washington. Kaplan is not the only Fed president who has flagged possible financial risks. Boston's Eric Rosengren has as well. But unlike Kaplan, he has said it's premature to talk about tapering bond purchases, though he's added that it's quite possible that the conditions for scaling back buying might be available towards the end of the year. While asset prices are not yet unusually buoyant, Rosengren suggested on a webinar on Wednesday that the Fed's very patient approach to reduce stimulus could result in them becoming so. If we get down to full employment by the end of next year with interest rates still quite low, I'm going to be highly attuned to what's happening in financial markets, he said. Which take us directly to the Fed's semi-annual financial stability report, which was released on Thursday. The report is a product of the Fed board in Washington, and it won't reflect the views of regional central bank presidents like Kaplan. The report says that a rising appetite for risk across a variety of asset markets is stretching valuations and creating vulnerabilities in the US financial system. The Fed pretty much summed it up as vulnerabilities associated with elevated risk appetites are rising, Fed Governor Lal Brainard, the head of the board's Financial Stability Committee, said in a statement accompanying the report. The combination of stretched valuations with very high levels of corporate indebtedness bear watching because of the potential to amplify the effects of a repricing event. In this environment, prices may be vulnerable to significant declines should risk appetite fall. Brainard in the report mentioned losses at banks stemming from dealings with Archegos Capital Management, and the governor called for more granular, high-frequency disclosures. The Archegos event illustrates the limited visibility into hedge fund exposures and serves as a reminder that available measures of hedge fund leverage may not be capturing important risks, she said. Now, of course, the Managed Funds Association, which represents hedge funds, took issue with Brainard's remarks. It is unfortunate policymakers incorrectly conflate hedge funds with unregulated entities like individuals and family offices, Association President Brian Corbett said in a statement. Hedge funds are well regulated by the Securities and Exchange Commission. Near zero interest rates and massive bond purchases, with the Fed buying $40 billion in mortgage-backed securities and $80 billion in treasuries every month, have fueled a search for returns and helped buoy asset prices, including those of risky investments such as speculative stocks, cryptocurrencies, and high-yield debt. The Standard & Poor's 500 stock index has risen 12% this year so far. The real story here is the tension, if not the glaring contradiction, of the Fed's pursuit of quantitative easing, the aim of which is to lower long-term rates and encourage reach for yield, and their concerns that people are indeed reaching for yield, said George Selgin, a senior fellow at the Cato Institute in Washington, referring to the bond buying. The Fed could certainly taper its QE activities to counter this risk-taking as the recovery continues. Indicators pointing to elevated risk appetite in equity markets in early 2021 included the episodes of high trading volumes and price volatility for so-called meme stocks, stocks that increased in trading volume after going viral on social media, the report said. Elevated equity issuance through SPACs also suggest a higher than typical appetite for risk among equity investors. Low rates are also impacting the real economy. Home prices are up 12% year over year amid high demand for property and scarce supply, while a boom in home remodeling has helped push lumber futures to record highs. The Bloomberg Commodity Index, which tracks everything from grain to natural gas and nickel, is up 19%. The report said house price increases have had a positive effect for borrowers by boosting equity. Still, it noted that borrowers in forbearance programs who are likely to be employed in industries hard hit by the pandemic could be vulnerable when they exit. Even so, a large fraction of borrowers have already exited forbearance, and in general, these borrowers have loans that are either current or paid off, the report said. And the report also noted that low interest rates have reduced default expectations and underwriting standards have weakened. The share of newly issued loans to large corporations with high leverage, defined as those with ratios of debt to earnings before interest, taxes, depreciation and amortization greater than 6, has exceeded the historic highs reached in recent years, it said. And the report also said that available data suggests that hedge funds are highly leveraged and said there is a need for greater transparency on opaque risk exposures, echoing Brainyard's call for more transparency. Some hedge funds with substantial short positions sustained losses during the MEM stock episode in January 2021, when intense social media activity contributed to fluctuations in the price of some specific stocks, the report said, probably a reference to the short squeeze in shares of GameStop Corp, which soared to more than $300 a share from around $20 a share in a matter of days. John Kaplis, chief executive officer at hedge fund consultant Pivotal Path, said after the report's release that one disclosure in particular could mitigate the risk of a future Archegos-like situation happening again. Before you try and rewrite all the regulatory statutes, you could make one small change that would be effective, he said. If you merely treat total return swaps in the same way hedge funds are already disclosing equity holdings, you would drastically mitigate an Archegos-like fallout from happening again. And over in England, the Bank of England expects the biggest surge in household spending since 1988, when Margaret Thatcher was Prime Minister, to help power a strong economic rebound after the pandemic. Officials, led by Governor Andrew Bailey, said they expect consumers to use up 10% of the savings glut built up during the lockdowns, double the pace previously forecast. The central bank also sees the UK's economy output recouping losses by the end of this year, instead of in early 2022. And while the Bank of England on Thursday opted to slow emergency bond buying in tune with a shift by some global counterparts towards descaling monetary stimulus, policymakers insisted this isn't a switch in stance. However, the strength of the recovery did lead outgoing chief economist Andy Haldane to cast a sole minority vote to end purchases sooner. The success of the UK's vaccine drive has driven down infection and death rates and allowed the government to stay on track to fully reopen the economy in June. The next stage in the loosening of restrictions is due later this month, when indoor hospitality will open and two households will be able to mix inside. This growing confidence in the recovery has enabled the bank to cut the weekly pace of its asset purchases, James Smith, an economist at ING, wrote in a report. While that shouldn't come as a huge surprise, he said, the next question is how and when the Bank of England will enter a formal tightening cycle. Officials remain confident that the recovery won't spur a sustained spike in inflation, though, although they see the risk of that as more balanced than before. And the central bank estimates consumers accumulated more than £200 billion during the pandemic, more than £125 billion estimated in November. Deputy Governor Ben Broadbent told journalists in a press conference on Thursday. The figures helped explain the Bank of England's bullish outlook for economic growth this year after pandemic lockdowns caused the worst recession in three centuries. It now sees the economy expanding 7.25% this year, with unemployment peaking at only 5.4% rather than the 7.8% as previously predicted. The impact of restrictions on activity appears to have been smaller than anticipated as households and companies have adapted, Bailey told reporters. But Haldane, who is set to quit the Bank of England in June, voted to cut the target for the current round of bond purchases to £100 billion from the present £150 billion, meaning the programme would finish in August rather than the end of the year. There was now clear evidence that the economy was growing rapidly, with both household and company spending surprisingly significantly and persistently to the upside, and consumer and business confidence bouncing back, he argued to his colleagues. The Bank of England did reduce the pace it buys government debt to £3.4 billion a week, £1 billion lower than the previous amount, although officials cautioned not to read too much into that tweak. Still, the more optimistic outlook may put the institution in a vanguard of global central banks starting to contemplate an end to crisis stimulus, reflecting a broader discussion in major economies about how long to keep emergency life support flowing. The Bank of England is already positioning itself at the hawkish end of the central bank spectrum, HSBC Holdings economists wrote in a report. The Bank of Canada has started tapering, but has no end date for purchases, while the US Fed is not expected to start tapering until the end of the year. Vivek Paul, the UK chief investment strategist at BlackRock Investments, cautioned that the sunnier outlook isn't a promise of sustainable expansion over time. It would be a mistake to extrapolate from eye-watering growth rates in the near term to stronger growth in the future, he said. After all, this is a restart, not a recovery. And here in Oz, the RBA has found a new excuse for the ultra-low rates, saying they are reluctant to raise interest rates to ease soaring house prices because it could cost jobs. In a speech on monetary policy during the COVID crisis, the Reserve Bank of Australia Deputy Governor Guy Debelle said the Reserve Bank of Australia will not raise interest rates to ease soaring house prices because tightening monetary policy could cost jobs. House price growth was encouraging spending, he argued. And he said that this was really a distributional problem which can affect inequality. It should be tackled with other policy levers. The RBA, of course, has dropped the official cash rate to a historic low of 0.1% and engaged in a program of bond buying worth $200 billion in total after a $100 billion expansion in February in response to the 2020 pandemic recession. Expansionary monetary and fiscal policy has resulted in better than expected economic growth and jobs recovery. Australian capital city house prices have surged by double digits, including an 8.5% quarterly increase in Sydney, where the median house price is now an eye-watering $1.31 million. Debelle, when delivering the Shan Memorial Lecture on Thursday, said lower interest rates had boosted borrowing and the cash flow of existing borrowers, as well as putting downward pressure on the Australian dollar. The cash rate supports asset prices, including housing prices, which boosts household wealth and hence spending, he said. Debelle said house prices, part of the transmission of expansionary monetary policies of the economy, has received a lot of attention, but he argued a rising market encouraged home building, along with government grants such as a home builder policy, which boosts activity and employment. The bank recognises that rising housing prices heightened concerns in parts of the community. Housing price rises can have distributional consequences, he said. This is certainly an issue that needs to be considered, and there are a number of tools that can be used to address the issue. But I do not think that monetary policy is one of the tools. And Debelle said that monetary policy was used to set employment and inflation, and that while housing prices may not rise as fast without the monetary stimulus, unemployment would definitely be materially higher without the monetary stimulus. And the Reserve Bank has in fact already signalled what will be in their upcoming quarterly statement on monetary policy, which is out later today. The central bank this week revised its growth projections, predicting the Australian economy will grow by 4.75% in 2021 and 3.5% in 2022. The unemployment rate is expected to continue to decline to be 5% at the end of this year and around 4.5% at the end of 2022, it said. Nevertheless, the central bank kept interest rates on hold, explaining it would not lift the cash rate until actual inflation is sustainably within the 2-3% target range, which is unlikely to be until 2024 at the earliest. Debelle confirmed those settings on Thursday evening, although he added that it is the state of the economy that is the key determinant of policy settings, not the calendar. And Debelle said that although unemployment had dropped to 5.6%, there was no upside surprise in inflation. He said that inflation was just over 1% in the year to March and is expected to spike to about 3% in the June quarter due to higher oil prices and free childcare, but then fall again below 2%. And DeBell noted that based on the three-year government bond rate, it appears the market is betting that the cash rate could be higher in 2024 than the board's current forward guidance. That would put some upward pressure on longer-term household and business borrowing rates, but the effect is unlikely to be that large, he said. And last week, the Federal Treasurer, Jos Frydenberg, revised the government's ambition from the previous goal of driving unemployment to comfortably below 6% to instead reaching pre-pandemic levels, promising to avoid austerity budgeting until the economic recovery is secured. Treasury now estimates that the non-accelerating inflation rate of employment is somewhere between 4.5 and 5% lower than a previous estimate of 5%, meaning the government will be pushing towards an unemployment figure with a 4 in front of it before moving towards fiscal repair. So you can see how these arguments are being manifest among central banks around the world. The question you need to ask, though, is that this massive rise in credit pouring into the housing sector in particular, and asset prices more generally, is something which needs ultimately to be tamed. And I think, personally, that interest rates are probably too low. But of course, banks do have other macroprudential tools that they could bring to bear. New Zealand, of course, has already started down this route. So the excuse that you've got a trade-off, house prices or jobs, is complete rubbish. It's not an either-or scenario. By pulling the right levers, including the right monetary policy levers, it is possible to tame housing prices while still maintaining relatively low interest rates. And I think that low interest rates are probably appropriate, particularly to encourage the commercial sector to borrow more. But you don't want this massive ballooning of prices for houses, nor asset prices for markets. And ultimately, it's going to be those which will either collapse under their own weight or be pulled back into line with different policy settings from the ones that are currently being advocated. But frankly, the concept that you've got to choose either higher prices for houses or a better jobs market is just disgracefully simplistic, naive, and frankly, a misdirection. I'm Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Many thanks for watching, and I'll see you again next time.